Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On today's Your Call, we continue our week-long series looking at President Obama's legacy and what he is leaving for Donald Trump. Yesterday, we discussed President Obama's foreign policy legacy, and today we're talking about his economic policies. During last week's farewell speech, he touched on his administration's achievements after the 2008 financial meltdown. He said, quote, "If I had told you 8 years ago that America would reverse a great recession, reboot our auto industry, and unleash the longest stretch of job creation in our history, you might have said our sights were set a little too high," end quote. Well, President Obama took office in the middle of the worst economic recession since the Great Depression, with the housing crisis and Wall Street speculation, which threatened the entire economy. His administration responded to the crisis with a $700 billion bailout package for Wall Street, followed by the 2010 Dodd-Frank bill, which was supposed to regulate Wall Street in order to prevent another financial crisis. So, did it? Well, not one high-level Wall Street executive was held responsible for the crisis. 8 years after the bailout, of the 15 banks that received the most bailout money, 11 are now bigger than they were before the recession, even after adjusting for inflation. Joining us to talk about President Obama's economic legacy and what he is leaving for Donald Trump are two guests. David Dayan is contributing writer for Salon and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. His new book is called Chain of Title: How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And you can find our interview with David about that book at yourcallradio.org. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Ruth.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Mary Kreiner Ramirez, professor of law at the Washburn University School of Law, where she teaches a course on white-collar crime. Mary is a former prosecutor for the Department of Justice's Antitrust Division, where she prosecuted white-collar criminals. And she is co-author of the book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. Hi, Mary. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you, Rose, for having me.
Well, it's great to have you. Let's go back to 2008 and talk about what President Obama walked into. He took office in the middle of the worst economic recession since the Great Depression. And then he also walked into massive, massive tax cuts. According to David K. Johnston, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, the Bush tax cuts have cost about $6.6 trillion. So, Mary, let's go back to 2008. Remind us what Obama walked into.
Well, I mean, I suppose he walked into the greatest financial crisis since the Great Recession. I mean, the Great Depression. And the banks were collapsing. There was a threat to the entire world market, at least the financial markets. And foreclosures were at an all-time high, but continued to grow for several years after he came into office.
And David, what would you add to that?
Yeah, certainly. You know, there was an atmosphere of crisis when President Obama took office. It was also something that famously Rahm Emanuel, his chief of staff in the first term, said, you never let a crisis go to waste. In crisis, you have opportunity to really remake and overhaul systems as you see fit. And so the real dividing line on what you think about the Obama presidency is whether he restored the status quo or whether he moved in a new direction.
And talk about how the crisis unfolded. David, we had you on recently about your book, Chain of Title, about the foreclosure fraud. Take us back to 2008 and just remind us how this crisis unfolded.
Sure. So really the housing bubble, which was this giant run-up in prices and an expansion of the number of mortgage loans that were taken out, that really popped at the end of 2006. And all through 2007 and 2008, there were expanded defaults and foreclosures double and triple the size of the previous year. And that really came to a head with the credit crisis, which you know, was a problem for the financial industry around September of 2008. And so the bailout gets passed in October of 2008 before President Obama takes office. However, he did participate in whipping up support for what was a distasteful process of bailing out the nation's financial institutions. And in doing that, he said that and promised skeptical Democratic lawmakers that he would do his part when he took office, if and when, this was before he got elected, to mitigate the impact of all of these foreclosures. There is written language in the bailout law, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP, that there will be efforts with this $700 billion. A portion of that money will be used to prevent unnecessary foreclosures. And so, you know, even after that, during the transition, Larry Summers, who was at that point the head of the Council of Economic Advisors, said that in a letter when they were releasing the second half of the bailout money, that they would undertake a $50 to $100 billion program, so a significant amount of that money, to mitigate foreclosures, and that also they would pursue this idea of changing the bankruptcy laws to give homeowners a more level playing field on negotiating with their lenders. Right now, bankruptcy judges cannot change the terms of primary residence mortgages. They wanted to change that, and what that would have had the effect of doing is, you know, give lenders the thought of either I, you know, make a workout with this homeowner, or a bankruptcy judge is going to do it for me. So, unfortunately, that didn't happen. The president did not, and his staff did not really try to engender support for that. They didn't put it into any must-pass bills. And it failed on the floor of the Senate. And this $50 to $100 billion program ended up being less than a $20 billion program over 8 years, and only $2 to $3 billion in the first year or two when foreclosures were spiking. And it really underperformed the promises that were made for that program. It's known as HAMP, and it actually ended at the end of 2016.
It's also important to remember who Obama surrounded himself with. Right now, we're talking a lot about the fact that Donald Trump has chosen Wall Street bankers, many people from Goldman Sachs, to run his cabinets. Mary, as you point out in your book, there really was no difference with President Obama. Key members of the administration benefited from close connections with Wall Street. You also point out that Obama's top source of contributions for his 2008 presidential campaign was the financial sector, and these connections would logically color the perceptions of the administration.
Right, that's absolutely true. I think one of the most disappointing things early in the Obama administration was to see him appoint so many people so close to the crisis as providing leadership during the crisis. One can hardly expect that the leaders, those who were deeply involved in the crisis, who could have perhaps had some ownership of the crisis, are very unlikely to press for harsh penalties or for allowing the banks to take a lot of responsibility with respect to the crisis. So I think that from the start we saw that as a problem. I think it came home to roost in this recent election when Bernie Sanders got a lot of traction based upon the failures of the Obama administration in addressing the bankers and the banking system in the crisis. So he really, I guess he put the fox in charge of the hen house, in a sense, and consequently it seemed that, as David pointed out, although there seemed to be expectations that homeowners and small banks and others would be protected in the resolution of the crisis, truly all the efforts went to bailing out the banks, bailing out AIG, bailing out those who seemed to have a large role in creating the crisis in the first place.
And Mary, what could the Obama administration have done when all of this started come crashing down? What could the administration have done at that point?
Well, I think there are several things. I think if you look back to the economic or the accounting crisis that we saw at the turn around 2000, 2001 with Enron and WorldCom and the large companies there. Really, the legislation that was put in place was delayed a little bit, but seemed to capture, or at least attempt to capture, some of the more gross offenses that occurred with respect to the accounting crisis. Here, the Dodd-Frank Act was postponed for 2 years after the worst of the crisis had passed and after there was an opportunity to take advantage of the crisis to install real reform. So I think there was a failure to use the crisis for reform legislation. But in addition to that, there were several investigations into what occurred during the financial crisis, what went wrong. And from those investigations, such as the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission, for example, there were recommendations for the Department of Justice to take a harder look at what had gone on behind the scenes and to investigate whether or not any wrongdoing occurred. Although it's difficult to know if what happened with respect to grand juries, there seems to be no evidence of any major grand jury investigations looking into whether or not there was criminal activity by any of the elites or higher echelon of the banks and the insurance company. Nevertheless, there's a lot of information that would suggest that at least a grand jury inquiry would have been appropriate in a number of cases. So the failure to do that, to look into those cases, I think, opened the door or created a moral hazard for more egregious conduct or additional egregious conduct to continue, for individuals to feel as though no one was being held accountable for their pain and for the hardships that the individuals who are losing their homes, losing their jobs due to the financial crisis, they felt that the Obama administration wasn't taking responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. One more thing I might add is, in addition, of course, you know, there was the opportunity to do grand jury investigations, but even beyond that, there were regulatory opportunities to take a hard look at the banks and determine whether or not the banks were too large and needed to be broken up, and nothing was done with respect to that. That opportunity was missed by the regulators as well, probably in part because, again, Obama had surrounded himself with folks who were too closely tied to the crisis.
And David, what would you add? What could the administration have done?
Just to follow up on that, several things. You mentioned the breaking up of the banks. Within Dodd-Frank, there was this amendment pushed by Sherrod Brown and Ted Kaufman that would have capped banks at a certain percentage of their assets as a percentage of GDP. And the Treasury Department, an unnamed Treasury official, told New York Magazine that if we would have been for it, it would have passed, but we weren't, so it didn't. Hmm. So they had direct responsibility here to water down and push away any kind of really stringent kinds of regulations that would have been on the banks at that time within the Dodd-Frank law, which was the major response to the crisis. With respect to prosecutions, yes, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission issued, and we know this through looking through their records, at over a dozen criminal referrals, including a criminal referral of the head of Citigroup at that time, Robert Rubin, who, you know, Tim Geithner and Larry Summers are protégés of Robert Rubin. And Rubin said that he was never brought in to the Justice Department for questioning at all. So we know that these referrals were done and that they seemingly weren't followed up upon. Then you get later into it when we find out that all of these foreclosures that occurred as a result of the crisis were being done through the use of false documents, millions of them all over the country, submitted into courts, millions of pieces of documentary evidence that was fictitious. And instead of using that as a leverage point to get better outcomes for homeowners and to hold responsible those who perpetrated the scheme, simply by doing the police work and asking why is this name on this fake document and who authorized you to put this name on it? Instead of that, there was a settlement that was made. It's really interesting that here, 2 weeks, you know, in the final weeks of the Obama presidency, there are criminal indictments coming out against executives at Volkswagen, executives at Takata, these corporate executives who committed fraud that led to really bad outcomes. But they're only doing it with 2 weeks to go, and it highlights even more the supreme negligence in failing to get some accountability for this massive crisis that caused the loss of homes for millions and millions of people.
And Mary, you point out in your book that on August 21st, 2014, the U.S. Department of Justice entered into a $16.6 billion settlement with Bank of America for fraud in connection with the subprime mortgage debacle. DOJ trumpeted the settlement as, quote, the largest civil settlement with a single entity in American history, end quote. But you point out that the bank faced no criminal charges and no individual employees faced criminal fraud charges.
Yes, that's absolutely true. And I think if you go through, you can see that there are many, many settlements that occurred as to resolve issues from the crisis, civil settlements. But what typically happens when you have situations like this is the Department of Justice would go after individuals on the expectation that, you know, no corporation can commit these frauds without individual actors. And had they begun to do so, I think they would have found that there was quite a few folks who probably would have been willing to cooperate with them. In fact, I think, if I understand David's book correctly, and we talk about it in our book as well, there were a lot of whistleblowers out there who were more than happy to work with the government to reveal what was going on behind the scenes and to provide some insight into the level of intent with which the actors were making decisions that may have led to these bad outcomes. There were actually a couple of civil cases against individuals such as Fabrice Touré at Goldman, but those were only against mid-level folks. The Fabrice Touré led to a jury verdict of civil fraud, and then there was also a case against Countrywide concerning Operation Hustle. Although there was a jury verdict of civil fraud there as well, it was ultimately reversed by the Second Circuit on a pleading issue.
The Touré case, just briefly, shows sort of, you know, one of the arguments and alibis that administration officials make is that these cases were so hard that juries would just get confused. The one civil case that we have as evidence that went to a jury is the Fabrice Touré case, and the jury did understand it, and they did bring a civil fraud claim. So it just sort of puts the lie, really, to that idea that this was all so complicated and complex that nobody could possibly understand it, and therefore we can't hold anybody responsible.
David Dayan is contributing writer to Salon and a weekly columnist for the Fiscal Times. His new book is Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Mary Kreiner Ramirez is professor of law at the Washburn University School of Law. She teaches a course on white-collar crime. She's a former prosecutor for the DOJ's Antitrust Division, where she prosecuted white-collar criminals. And she's co-author of the new book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. Mary, when I first got your book, I thought, wow, what a title, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty.
Yes. Well, certainly we recognize that would at least attract some attention. But indeed, I think that's the struggle, isn't it, that corporations can exist for a very long time, and we can't jail them. Soul to damn, no body to kick, I think is the phrase that's used with respect to corporations. But I think that we have been trying, and Congress has put on the book legislation that would permit the corporate death penalty for the banks, for example, in this sort of situation where the holding companies or holding companies with subsidiaries could have those banks broken up. It doesn't require a criminal conviction. It just requires a conclusion that there's reasonable cause to believe that action constitutes a serious risk to the financial safety, soundness, or stability of a bank holding company subsidiary and is inconsistent with sound banking principles. So I think that certainly it seemed that there was a lot of that conduct going on here.
And Mary, you also point out something interesting in your book. You write that massive fraud and other crimes caused the crisis, and the government let the perpetrators get away with billions in loot, while the global economy suffered trillions in losses that we all paid. You say that the American people essentially were deprived of the most accurate and reliable instrument for learning the truth behind the financial crisis.
That's true. I mean, that's exactly one opportunity that an investigation, and if there is a criminal case brought, then the opportunity to take a look to see what happened. It allows the government to put on its best case using the evidence that it has, and it allows the defense to demonstrate why the government's got it wrong, if the government does. But at least the American people could be satisfied that a close look was at least taken. I'm not saying that the government should, of course, charge people with crimes unless there was probable cause to believe that there was a crime, but it would seem that the government did not even take the first step, and that would be opening grand jury investigations and taking a hard look at the evidence, both from the criminal referrals and from their own review of the evidence. There was a lot developed in these cases.
David, what about that point, that it's important to take this to court so people learn about what actually happened? Because I still hear people say, well, it's citizens' faults. They're the ones that signed the line, and they took these loans.
Right. So there are so many reasons why this would have been beneficial. Number one, a full and public accounting, as you mentioned, of exactly what happened, and putting that in full view of the American people would have been desirable. The second thing is providing a deterrent for future behavior, because in the absence of any accountability for wrongdoing simply perpetuates. Third is this, ending this idea that there's a two-tiered system of justice, and that if you're rich and powerful, you can get away with things that other people can't. And I think that sort of breakdown in the social fabric and this loss of faith in the criminal justice system and the justice system in general explains a lot of what happened in 2016 in the election. So I kind of look at those three points, and when you put that all together, and you can even add beneficial aspects to economic performance. You know, we had a slow recovery, and there are very good studies that show that one of the reasons why the recovery was so slow to come back is that people had this massive debt overhang from these threats of foreclosure, from these bad loans, and the fact that they weren't taken care of meant that they didn't engage in consumer spending. So if you look at areas that were most hard hit by foreclosures, those were also the areas that took the longest to come back. And so if you had some sort of workout and resolution on a global scale that actually did some good and made an equitable solution and allocated these losses, these massive losses that came from the system, on banks and homeowners rather than just on the homeowners, you would have had better economic performance. So this made sense on so many levels, and it's just a missed opportunity, and you can't talk about the Obama legacy without talking about this aspect.
David Diane is contributing writer to Salon and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Mary Kreiner Ramirez is professor of law at the Washburn University School of Law and co-author of The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. Today, we are continuing our week-long series looking at President Obama's legacy and what he is leaving for Donald Trump. Today, we're talking about the economic policies of the administration, specifically how the administration responded to the 2008 financial meltdown. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
Your call is better when you get involved. If you have a question, idea, or experience you wish to contribute to today's conversation, call us at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment at the show's website. Set a bookmark for yourcallradio.org, and you can also tweet us at yourcallradio. At 11 o'clock in a half an hour, BBC World Have Your Say takes us to Baltimore, Maryland, asking people there what a President Trump could do for them. BBC World Have Your Say, 1/2 hour from now at 11 o'clock here on 91.7 KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll continue our series looking at Obama's legacy by focusing on the environment. He protected a record 548 million acres of natural habitat, banned new oil and gas drilling in the Arctic, and invested billions in clean energy technology. He also approved 1,500 offshore fracking permits in the Gulf of Mexico and bragged about rising U.S. oil output. So how do you grade Obama's environmental record? Thursday, we'll be talking about his record on immigration. And then Friday, it is Inauguration Day, and we're going to have a two-hour special from 10 to noon. We're going to do our regular media roundtable. We will also talk about President Obama's legacy with journalists and his crackdown on journalists and what he's leaving for Donald Trump. And then we're starting a new Book of the Month Club. We're kicking it off with No Shortcuts, Organizing for Power in the New Gilded Age. Labor activist Jane McAlevey will join us on January 24th next week. So I hope you can grab a copy of her book, read it, and then call us with your views and questions. Again, Jane McAlevey will be with us next Tuesday. Today we are talking about President Obama's legacy on the environment and on the economy and how the administration responded to the 2008 financial meltdown. And we're discussing this today with David Diane, contributing writer to Salon and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. Mary Kreiner Ramirez is professor of law at the Washburn University School of Law, where she teaches a course on white-collar crime. She's a former prosecutor with the DOJ's Antitrust Division, where she prosecuted white-collar criminals, and she's co-author of the new book, The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. And if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments about President Obama's economic legacy, what are your thoughts on how the administration responded to the financial meltdown? If you were affected by that, if you or someone you know lost your home or a family member's home, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Mary, you point out in your book, and this is what Attorney General Eric Holder said when the crisis happened. He said that bringing the most powerful economic criminals to justice would harm the economy. We heard that from a number of high-level Obama administration officials. What's your response to that?
Well, my first response would be that certainly the economy is a very complex system, but if his administration had gone after the individuals involved, it would seem that one individual does not an economy make, or even a whole host of bankers would not necessarily harm the economy. I mean, in the accounting crisis, they went after the leaders of very, very large organizations without any harm to the economy. So I think that that's a handy excuse, I suppose. But I think that we cannot allow ourselves to believe that anybody is too big to face the repercussions of their conduct in the United States.
And David, what are your thoughts? So many officials said bringing these economic, very powerful people to justice would really harm the economy.
Right, and this was famously called too big to jail. Mm. To sort of go along with too big to fail, and I think Mary kind of captures it. The idea that one individual is so indispensable to a company or the economy at large that their departure would send the send things reeling it just doesn't hold up to any standard of evidence.
We have an email from Rob who says, "Here are the biggest failures in the last 8 years." Failure to prosecute Wall Street. The Reagan administration did it during the SNL crisis, but Eric Holder came from Wall Street and went back there. Although, is he going back to Wall Street?
Well, it wasn't Wall Street, but he did work for a corporate law firm called Covington & Burling,
okay,
which is based in Washington, and he did go back there. And in fact, Covington & Burling built a new headquarters right before Eric Holder's end of his attorney general tenure. And they kept a corner office held for him while he was the attorney general negotiating with banks who were clients of Covington and Burling. You know, we talk about how the Obama administration didn't have any scandals. I don't know why that wasn't an incredible scandal.
Eric Holder has been tapped by California government officials for legal counsel.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
I'm not sure why it's necessary. I mean, it's supposed to be done in response to possible actions that the state of California might take because of the Trump administration.
Right.
But that's really the purview of the Attorney General of California, who's going to be Xavier Becerra. And I'm not sure what is needed on the part of Eric Holder and what expertise and what he can bring to the table. What I do know is that Covington and Burling has an office in Los Angeles, and a partner of it is the brother of a man named John Shulman, who's the main consultant for the state Senate leader, Kevin DeLeon, who put forward this contract with Covington and Burling.
Hmm.
So read between the lines.
Wow. What about the argument that we talked about this briefly, but that the banks were just too big to fail and that the financial system would be drastically harmed if they went after these banks?
Well, is that to me?
Yeah, David, go ahead first.
Okay. So that argument gets less and less relevant the further and further out you go from the crisis. As we hit 2010, 2011, the credit crisis is basically wrapped up. The stress tests and the other factors that the Treasury Department and other regulators put in place have stabilized the system. And yet this excuse continues to be made. And, of course, the big national mortgage settlement happens in 2012, 4 years removed from the heart of the crisis. So I don't know what the statute of limitations is on that excuse.
And what would you add, Mary? And also, can you talk about the precedent that this sets?
Sure. Well, I would add to the first point is that we had the savings and loan crisis. And during that crisis, savings and loan companies were closed and the economy did not fail. Of course, these are very large banks, but if you just broke them up into smaller banks, into regional banks, I think you could. I believe the regulators could have not only. I believe the regulators could have set it up so that in the future, going forward, there would be less pressure that the banks seem to have to compete with each other in that way. With respect to going forward, I think any time egregious conduct is left unaddressed, and it certainly tells those individuals that they can move forward with impunity without worry. And I think that the robo-signing that David talked about with respect to the fraudulent documents submitted in the foreclosure cases is exactly an example of that, a recognition that no one was going to go after those banks and that they could continue to act with impunity. Mm-hmm. I think going forward, it suggests more of the same. I think the banks, have, as you pointed out, have only become stronger. They have more resources available with which to promote de-legislation, to avoid legislation that could hem them in. And so I think it bodes ill for our country. I think that Donald Trump had promised to drain the swamp, but it looks as though he's just filling it up with different alligators.
Yeah, and we'll talk about that later in the show. Today we are talking about President Obama's economic legacy with Mary Kreiner Ramirez. She's co-author of The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. She's professor of law at the Washburn University School of Law, former prosecutor with the DOJ's Antitrust Division, where she prosecuted white-collar criminals. And David Dayan is a contributing writer to Salon and author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. What questions or comments do you have about President Obama's economic legacy? If you were affected by the 2008 financial meltdown, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our Twitter or our Facebook page. Let's talk about Dodd-Frank. It passed in 2010, Wall Street reform. It was supposed to re-regulate the financial sector, tighten capital requirements on large banks. It created the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to crack down on abusive lending products. Mary, in your book, you point out that the Dodd-Frank Act failed to impose any new significant criminal liabilities at all and stands as the primary response to the financial crisis of 2008. So what are your thoughts on Dodd-Frank? What has its impact been on Wall Street?
Well, I think that, I think the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau was a nice addition, but I don't think it did anything significant to hem in the banks whatsoever in their activities. Certainly, I think that the crisis was an opportunity to reimpose Glass-Steagall if they had wanted to do so. In my opinion, it was a huge failure. There have been, I guess if you take it apart, there are some things. For example, it offered greater whistleblower protection, and now the SEC has a whistleblower protection board that has had some successes, and so that's terrific. But there have been some minor benefits, but for the most part, with respect to the large problem, the financial crisis, it seems to have done virtually nothing.
What's your take, Dave?
Well, Dodd-Frank wasn't so much a law as a promise to write a law later. The regulators were given wide latitude within Dodd-Frank. There were almost no hard and direct rules that were set through Congress under Dodd-Frank, and this gave sort of an opportunity for the banking industry to get another bite at the apple. Once they did what they could to water down or prevent certain aspects of the Dodd-Frank legislation, then they could go to the regulators and water down and prevent certain aspects of the regulations that were written after Dodd-Frank. In fact, not even all of the regulations have been written right now. And we're 6 years after the legislation has been passed, and so I think Mary's right that it was really a sort of looking backward rather than looking forward kind of legislation that was concerned with fighting the last war, concerned with the kinds of things that came up at that time during the financial crisis, and it wasn't looking to overhaul the system, but really make some minor tweaks to the system. Now some of the things are positive, definitely. I think the expansion of capital requirements, the regulators have actually been very good on that. It forces banks to have more reserves to absorb losses if they get into trouble, so they pay for their own mistakes rather than taxpayers paying for it. So that's definitely positive, And actually, I think Republicans, that's sort of the one thing that they might continue in the wake of Dodd-Frank. But on most other things, it just didn't look at the system as a whole and say this system needs to be changed, because we can't have a situation again where one collapse of one firm in one corner of the system can ripple through it, because everybody's so interconnected, and bring the system to its knees.
And Dave, can you remind us what the Volcker rule was supposed to do and what it is doing? Because according to the International Business Times, over the past couple of weeks, half a dozen lobbyists said that they have met with Donald Trump's legislative staff to discuss a rollback of the Volcker rule.
The Volcker rule is kind of the weak sister of Glass-Steagall. Under the Volcker rule, banks who get deposits from and deposit insurance from the government cannot trade on their own account with depositor money. So it's not a complete restriction between investment banks and commercial banks, but it says certain types of trades cannot be made by deposit-taking banks. And so this is something that has been the subject of very contentious debate. Several regulatory agencies had to agree to get the Volcker rule into motion. There were loopholes put in it at that time, and it still represents something that the banks want to do away with, and so, as you can see, it's a top priority of theirs under a Trump administration.
And, you know, so many headlines, so many politicians say that this foreclosure crisis is over, but you both argue that it's not. And, Mary, that's one of your arguments in your book. Because the administration did not crack down on high-level executives, this could possibly happen again. And, David, you have said that people are still losing their homes. So, Mary, what are your thoughts?
Right. It definitely is not over. I think that the lessons learned from this, that the banks can act with impunity, that they can use their financial resources to seek out legislation, lobby for legislation that is permits them more latitude, is going to continue. There is a 10-year statute of limitations on a lot of the bank activity that is still hanging out there, probably until at least 2017, 2018 for some folks, although given, you know, the lateness in the day, it's unlikely, I think, to see any movement on that. But that is something that Trump could do if the administration wanted to. But yeah, I think that there's a lesson learned there, and until there's some sort of clear movement to the contrary, I would expect further behavior to continue.
David?
Yeah, what's so interesting is that here we are in 2017, and 60% of all foreclosure activity that's going through the system is still on loans that were originated during the housing bubble, and that's from 2003 to 2006. These loans were so toxic that they represent still the majority of foreclosure activity in the country. And because we made a choice to essentially ignore the crisis as it happened, the shocks of it and the various problems with it still persist to this day. It's really quite staggering.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you both also where we are today. Bernie Sanders on the campaign trail said that the biggest banks have gotten much bigger, and the Washington Post had a piece about that and found that the four banks receiving the most funds, Bank of America, Citigroup, JPMorgan Chase, and Wells Fargo, are now even bigger than they were. So what effect, Mary, will this have on the economy moving forward?
Well, I think any time you have a contraction in competitors, there's often the opportunity for them to move in the same direction, employ the same sort of activities. I think that's part of what happened in the crisis, as folks saw what different banks were doing. I would expect that sort of conduct would continue. I also think that it's easier for them to align to
lawfully seek legislation that is favorable to them, such as repealing the Volcker Act or getting rid of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which has imposed some frustrations on the banks. So I think that the smaller community only means a greater alignment of their interests that are not necessarily the same interests that the American people have.
And David, looking at Donald Trump's cabinet, he chose Steve Mnuchin to run the Treasury Department.
Yeah.
Mnuchin is a hedge fund manager who worked for Goldman Sachs. Wilbur Ross, a billionaire private equity investor, was chosen to run the Commerce Department. Goldman Sachs president and COO Gary Cohn has been selected to lead the National Economic Council. That is the West Wing office that helps the president set economic policy. And then Jay Clayton has been tapped to head the SEC. He's a partner at a law firm whose clients include Goldman Sachs, and he advised the bank when it accepted the $5 billion TARP bailout. So what do you think's going to happen, David? Do you think that we'll go back to casino-like Wall Street practices with these men in power?
I mean, take a look at the stock indexes for major financial institutions. They're soaring since the Trump election victory. They know that the eyes are going to be off them. The cops are going to come off the beat. They're going to get major tax cuts, the individual executives at least, and probably the corporations as well. And they're ready for a return to the go-go days. The casino is back open for business.
Wow.
That's certainly the case. And then when you look at Mnuchin, I mean, Goldman Sachs is almost the best part of his resume. He was the CEO of One West Bank, which has been described as a foreclosure machine, particularly here in California, where it foreclosed just in California on over 36,000 homeowners in just a 3 or 4 year span. There have been protests around the country around Mnuchin's nomination because of the various practices, very ruthless practices, some of them illegal practices that One West took. I'm going to be attending an event at Mnuchin's home in Bel Air tomorrow, which will, you know, seek to tell the facts about his bank that he managed. So as far as the thing that we've been talking about in this conversation, which is foreclosures, you're literally putting someone who profited off the foreclosure crisis in a position of extreme power.
And Mnuchin said that his number one priority is tax reform, cutting corporate taxes. David, what do you expect from corporate Democrats? Because the International Business Times, in that piece about lobbyists meeting with Trump's legislative staff to discuss a rollback on the Volcker Rule, said they also are going to court business-friendly Democrats like Joe Manchin in West Virginia, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Joe Donnelly in Indiana. The list goes on. What do you think we're going to see from corporate Dems in the next couple of years?
Well, there aren't that many left, number one. Democrats have been so wiped out in Congress that they kind of hold seats that are in their own enclaves. Now, with respect to the Senate, there are 10 senators up for re-election next year who represent states that Trump won in 2016. And these are the 10 senators that you really have to watch. And all three that you mentioned are in that number. Heitkamp, Manchin, and Donnelly are up for re-election in 2018, and they all represent states that went very strongly for Donald Trump. So they have to sort of manage that and figure out where, you know, what they need to do in order to get re-elected if, in fact, they're running for re-election. So it's going to be an issue. The Democrats can lose up to 8. Anything that requires 60 votes is going to need the support of 8 Democrats at least in order to pass it. And so there is you could see Manchin, Heitkamp, Donnelly take a walk on some issues, but once you get deeper down, it's going to be more difficult for Republicans to find that support. However, they can sort of bend the rules, and there are certain types of votes, like on tax reform, where they only require a 51-vote majority. And so I think on tax reform, which is, I think, the big thing that, that the Trump administration is going to be able to get passed, they're really only going to need a majority for that.
Wow. And Mary, final thoughts from you. We didn't have time to really talk about how Obama's economic policies affected average people, especially struggling people. People of color were hit really hard by the foreclosure crisis. I mean, this is such a massive topic. But when you look at President Obama and the decisions the administration made or didn't made, how would you grade him overall on how those decisions affected people, especially people who are struggling to make ends meet?
Well, when we're talking about the financial crisis, I would say that he is, I'm sitting at a D or possibly an F, because the crisis was so big and the response was so weak with respect to preventing future problems, or with respect to taking care of the American people as individuals, all the people who lost their homes, the people you mentioned, people of color. There was lots of evidence that that the subprime crisis hit them harder. One, because most of their savings is tied up in their homes. It's true for everyone, but for your average American, your home represents a lot of your savings, and so the loss of that was a complete wipeout for many people. But in addition to that, the mortgages were written with higher interest rates for people of color, in a what appears to be just a straight up expectation that they could get it because of perhaps a lack of experience with prior home ownership, because these were people, often folks who had strong credit and could have obtained something less than a subprime loan, but the loans were written because subprime loans provided bigger fees to the mortgage companies.
Mary Kreiner Ramirez is professor of law at the Washburn University School of Law and co-author of The Case for the Corporate Death Penalty, Restoring Law and Order on Wall Street. David Diane is the author of Chain of Title, How Three Ordinary Americans Uncovered Wall Street's Great Foreclosure Fraud. He writes for many publications. David and Mary, thank you both for joining us.
All right, thank you.
Thank you so much. And coming up on tomorrow's show, we will be discussing President Obama's environmental legacy. He protected a record 548 million acres of natural habitat, banned new oil and gas drilling in the Arctic, invested billions in clean energy technology, but he also approved 1,500 offshore fracking permits in the Gulf of Mexico and bragged about rising U.S. oil output. So how do you grade Obama's environmental record? Your call is produced here at KALW. Malie Hay-Razazan produced today's show. Helena Murphy and Stephanie Purcell are our volunteers. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thanks for joining us.